Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First up, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Berkeley economist Brad DeLong on the fiscal madness in D.C. And then at the bottom of the hour, Seth Ackerman, one of the editors of an excellent young publication, edited by a bunch of excellent young people, Jacobin, on his piece in the current issue of that magazine on what a possible socialist economy might look like. Little time for news commentary today, except to say what a ludicrous way of running a government we have. The process is insane, and rich people have it way too easy. But there's a lot more of this to come. The date with the cliff has simply been pushed back by 2 months, and the Treasury is going to have to do some financial gymnastics over the coming weeks to keep the government current on its bills, since it's run into the debt ceiling that congressional Republicans refuse to raise. There's going to be lots of hideous politicking about spending cuts, with the Republicans wanting deep ones and Democrats modest ones. It's going to be a battle between austerity heavy and austerity light, with almost no one standing up for economic stimulus and decent treatment of the old, the sick, and the poor. What a country. Okay, here's Brad DeLong, a professor of economics at Berkeley, who's spending this academic year in Kansas City. Unlike most academics, Brad spent some time in the wacky world of Washington, working in the Treasury Department under Bill Clinton and Robert Rubin. Apologies for the crummy quality of the cell phone signal. These things keep proliferating, and they're a radio producer's nightmare. This interview was recorded the day before the fiscal cliff deal passed Congress, so some of the commentary is obsolete, but the political economy is anything but. Brad DeLong. Welcome, Brad. Have you been one of those panicking at the imminent fiscal cliff?
I wouldn't say panicking. I would say concerned. That is, the Congress and the President, in their infinite wisdom, have set up a situation in which, starting tomorrow, they essentially hit the economy on the head with a brick. And if no agreement is reached between now and June 30th, then the laws that they've passed continue to roll forward. The brick is going to be big enough to give us a 2013 during which the U.S. economy goes into renewed recession. You know, real GDP falls by 1.5% or so, and the unemployment rate goes back up from 7.7% to 9%. And that's an extra 2 million people without jobs in an economy that's already running at massively subnormal unemployment, subnormal employment. That's a very bad thing to happen. That's a thing that's worth giving away a bunch in order to avoid. Of course, if you just go over the fiscal cliff for one day or 1 week, or maybe even 1 month, relatively little of that damage takes place. That damage is a gridlock until June scenario.
Now, there are some people who are saying it's worth it, given the mix of policies, which is cuts in defense spending, which would not otherwise be possible, rises in top tax rates, which would not otherwise be possible. So maybe it's worth taking for all that economic risk. What do you think of that?
It's also a huge whomp on various forms of discretionary spending, of non-defense discretionary spending, of which we're doing much too little anyway. And there is the fact that there is another debt ceiling debate out there to be held in 2 or 3 more months. You know, then it's unclear how many of the gains from going over the fiscal cliff, from your perspective and my perspective, would actually survive, you know, the debt ceiling deal that's to be made or not to be made in 2 or 3 months. Going over the fiscal cliff is essentially committing the government to hit the economy on the head repeatedly and send the economy into recession unless you reach a deal pretty soon. The hope is that if you go over the fiscal cliff, you then reach a good deal. The question is, if you're going to reach a good deal and you go over the fiscal cliff, why can't you reach a good deal now? Because everyone can see what's coming down the tracks.
Now, you're certainly not, don't have particular inside access right now, but you spent some time in government. What's your sense? Is more going on than is publicly known, or are we pretty much aware of all the negotiations and all the dealing?
I can't tell. That is, the way things were supposed to work was that Obama was supposed to strike a deal with the House Republicans, and then Nancy Pelosi would release the House Democratic votes needed to offset whatever right-wing defections Boehner suffered in the House, And then the Senate was supposed to agree to what, you know, that's the House Republicans and Obama had agreed to. And so then we would kind of have a deal. However, Obama made his last and final offer. Boehner then rejected it and said, why don't you, Obama, go and start negotiating with McConnell and Reid over in the Senate, starting with your final offer as your original offer. Now, Obama and Reid and McConnell seem to be on the point of reaching a deal, which is considerably to the right, as best we can tell, of what Obama said was his final offer to the House Republicans. But even if that passes the Senate, Boehner has not yet signed on to it. So what would happen next is that if this thing passes the Senate, then presumably Obama then has to take the Senate deal as his starting negotiating position and go back to the House Republicans and negotiate with them, you know, all over again. And this smells very much like Obama being taken for a ride by the used car dealer, whereby you make a deal with the salesman, and the salesman says, this is a wonderful deal, but I don't know if my finance manager will approve it. And then after the finance manager approves something, he says, this is a wonderful deal, but I don't know if the boss will approve it. And so you get whipsawed by having to negotiate some three or four times before you finally reach a deal, and it's not a terribly good deal from your perspective. And that, I think, is why this afternoon, kind of the great and good of the smart liberal opinion masters in Washington, by Paul Krugman, Noam Scheider, of the good part of the New Republic, Timothy Noah of the good part of the New Republic, Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine, have all come out against what Obama is currently thinking of agreeing to with Reid and McConnell, and saying better to actually go over the fiscal cliff and then start the negotiations up again come Wednesday.
The conventional opinion seems to be that that Obama has the upper hand in negotiations. One, do you buy that? And two, if so, why is he seen to be giving away so much?
I think he does have the upper hand in negotiations after January 1st comes around. Because then what happens is the U.S. economy is staring recession in the face unless a deal is reached. And there's a deal to be made that involves an awful lot of cuts in taxes relative to what will then be law for an awful lot of people. And it'll be relatively hard for Republicans to stand firm and say the Democrats are offering a tax cut to 98% of Americans and are offering spending changes that will alleviate a recession. And that's not good enough for us. We are going to be holding the U.S. economy and your tax cut hostage for our top 2% paymasters. That come January 2nd, it's kind of easy for the administration to have negotiating power, to flex negotiating power, and to use it. The problem is that if Obama lets the economy go over this fiscal cliff, he's rolling the dice. He's rolling the dice that financial markets won't immediately panic and provoke a capital strike, a collapse in investment spending. And he's betting that public opinion will move in his direction rather than the Republicans. That the Republicans, rather than he, will be blamed for having failed to come to an agreement. And if there's one thing we've learned about Obama over the past 5 years, it's that he's an odd combination of incredibly optimistic about things he's involved in and also incredibly risk-averse, that he thinks things will work out in the end very well for him, so he doesn't like to take things that he perceives as big risks. And, you know, that appears to be why he's abandoning negotiating positions that he'd said were lines in the sand kind of 6 weeks ago. 6 weeks ago, he said the fiscal cliff deal had to include a permanent resolution of the debt ceiling problem. 6 weeks ago, he said that the fiscal cliff deal had to raise taxes on that portion of your income that's more than $250,000 a year back to the Clinton-era kind of the Clinton level. 6 weeks ago, he said that it was not negotiable that the fiscal cliff deal had to include not just debt ceiling and tax provisions that he liked, but also enough short-term fiscal stimulus to kind of actually boost economic growth over the course of the next year. Now, all these things seem to have gone away, that there's no debt ceiling deal, that if the tranche of income between $250,000 and $450,000 a year, Obama's agreed that your tax rates aren't going to go up at all. And the stimulus, right, the actual stuff to boost employment in 2003 and increase economic growth and not just avoid a recession, has gone completely away. And these are, from my perspective, big and surprising concessions to have already made.
I'm speaking with Brad DeLong, professor of economics at Berkeley.
Well, what if it's really sort of what he believes?
That he should every 3 months ago have to make additional concessions to the Republicans to get an extra 3 month increase in the debt ceiling. He doesn't believe that. That the economy doesn't need additional kind of stimulus, that the recovery isn't proceeding at too slow a pace. It's possible he believes that. Certainly, the economists who were the left wing of the administration in 2009, you know, Christina Romer and Larry Summers, are gone, and they haven't been replaced. And you probably have unprintable things to say about an administration in which Larry Summers is on the left wing of the set of economic policymakers. But still, Alan Krueger is a smart guy and is in debt. And believe in economics as much as any of us do. And at this point, where the economy still has too little spending in it, more spending in the short run is a good thing. And as for the stimulus, we had the debt ceiling. There is a potential problem that Obama has always been leery of appearing to wish to raise taxes on the middle class. And yet Obama has also held to traditional Democratic priorities and ideas about the size of the federal government, especially if you add the Affordable Care Act, which significantly increases the amount of spending that the government is going to have to do, because we are, after all, going to be giving 40 million more people money to pay when they go to the doctor. And if you believe in traditional Democratic views as to the proper role of the government, and if you believe in the Affordable Care Act as well, then you're looking at federal government spending share of GDP over the next generation, around 25-26% of GDP, rather than 20%. And yet, with taxes at their current levels, even with kind of raising tax the upper bracket, you're looking at 18 or 19% of GDP in revenue, and 19 is an awful lot less than 26. Now, at least the belief is that this gap between 19 and 26% is, A, not a problem as long as we continue to be in this world in which everyone is desperate to have the U.S. government hold their money and in which people are willing to lend the U.S. government money at negative 2% real interest per year, right? That the government borrows the money, it spends it, it rolls over the debt, and each year it rolls over the debt. The debt gets 2% smaller in real terms, and the economy grows 3% in real terms, and so the debt incurred as a share of GDP shrinks by 5% of GDP in real terms. Basically, you're taxing the rich of the world by giving them a safe place to keep their money, which they value a lot. And as long as that holds, the gap between spending and revenue isn't a big problem. Now, that may not hold forever. And when people stop being willing to pay the U.S. government to keep their money safe for them and start demanding that they actually be paid for lending the U.S. government money, then either taxes will have to go up a lot quickly or spending will have to come down a lot quickly. The obvious things to do are to kind of start taxing that portion of people's incomes which currently goes as untaxed benefits on the one hand, or to actually impose a carbon tax and try to do something to them to kind of slow down global warming while also raising extra revenue as well. And there is a partial kind of taxing of benefits in the Affordable Care Act in its guts, which Congress may or may not actually allow to go into effect. But those are the two possible ways to square the circle and get taxes up to the spending level that Obama says that he wants, and yet he hasn't pushed either of those terribly strongly over the past 4 years. And if he wants to say that income taxes on middle-class taxpayers simply aren't going up, then either he's betting on one or both of those two, or he's betting that the current configuration in which people are willing to lend the U.S. government money at less than zero real interest rates to continue indefinitely.
There seems to be at least a pressure group, Fix the Debt Hysterics, who want to fix some long-term fiscal problems under the pressure of this fiscal cliff and do it in ways that might not be all that popular. What's your thinking on just how quickly these fiscal imbalances have to be addressed? Is this a project of years or months or what?
Decades. It's a project of decades. It might become a project of years, you know, if financial markets suddenly turn on a dime and change their minds, which they may well do. They do change their minds radically, occasionally, periodically. They really changed their mind about the value of dot-com companies in 2001. They really changed their mind about the value of mortgage-backed securities in 2007. If they suddenly change their mind about the value of U.S. Treasury debt, then it does become an adjustment that has to be done in years, and in a fairly small number of years, less than five. At the moment, there are no signs of that, and so at the moment, it seems that resolving the long-run imbalance between spending and taxes for the U.S. government is a problem that we dealt with over decades, and not even over years, and definitely not over the course of the next 6 hours. And in fact, if you look at the deals that are right now on the plate, they're deals that don't do anything in order to bring revenues and spending back into balance for the United States as a whole. You know, they're deals that do very little relative to current policy in terms of actually bringing things back into balance.
And do you share the relaxed attitude that someone like Jamie Galbraith has towards the future course of deficits? Do you think that CBO's projections are valid or not?
Well, CBOs are always, if this goes on, that if the Federal Reserve keeps its 2% per year inflation target, and if real GDP remains upon its growth track, and if no changes are made to tax and spending laws, or if only the changes to tax and spending laws the CBO incorporates in its alternative fiscal baseline are made, this is what would then happen. And the CBO admits, and in fact glories in the fact, that this is inconsistent, that if you have these deficits, then you will have to have faster increased rates of inflation as the government winds up issuing more debt, and the Federal Reserve then finds that people won't buy that debt, and it has to buy the debt. So that, you know, the set of CBO forecasts is itself an inconsistent set of scenarios. All the pieces of it can't fit together. And that's part of what Jamie is saying. The rest of what Jamie is saying is that, hey, the way that it will work if you try to do all these things is that you'll wind up having a decade or maybe two decades during which inflation proceeds at 10% per year or so, and in which the debt that the U.S. government owes is slowly inflated away, and we wind up effectively taxing the debt holders, who are overwhelmingly either A, rich, or B, are the People's Bank of China. And while you might feel guilty about using the inflation tax on China, which is a poor country, you can feel considerably better about using the inflation tax on the wealth of the princes of the Chinese Communist Party, which is probably what a tax on China's treasury bond holding actually is. So from Jamie's perspective, failing to resolve America's fiscal dilemmas is, in fact, a decision to, in the long run, tax the wealthy holders of treasury bonds through a process of moderate inflation, which he thinks doesn't do much damage to production or employment or long-term growth, and in fact is probably a boost, because as long as you have too much money chasing too few goods, you'll have an awful lot of people at work. And it's true, the world could work that way. And if the world could work that way, then Jamie is right. And going over the fiscal cliff and failing to resolve America's imbalance between spending and taxes turns into a progressive tax increase in a high employment economy. I'm not sure that's right. I'm not sure you can do that. I'm not sure how it would work out. But if Jamie's right on his analytics, then he's right on the political economy as well.
That was Brad DeLong of the Berkeley Economics Department, who's spending this year in the exotic locale of Kansas City. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Crowd Surf Off a Cliff by Emily Haynes and Soft Skeleton in honor of the fiscal you-know-what. As I've said before when I played Haynes, I worry that I'm going soft. But under the sweet voice, the lyrics are reassuringly dark. Next up, Seth Ackerman. Seth is the author of a piece in the current issue of Jacobin, a fine new magazine, of which he is one of the editors, on what a possible socialist economy might look like. You can find Jacobin on the web at jacobinmag.com. All one word, jacobinmag.com. I, like many cranky radicals, spent a lot of time on the ruthless criticism of all that exists, to steal a phrase from Marx, but like Marx, little on what a better world might look like. I resolve every now and then to be more positive, but I'm usually overcome by a relapse of the critical urge. But here's an extended exception. Seth Ackerman. Welcome, Seth. You open your piece by recounting the long-standing suspicion that people on the left, especially the Marxist left, have had towards devising blueprints for a better future, starting with Marx. Could you just review some of that history and tell us why it might be kind of unfortunate?
It's a long tradition on the left, and part of it, I think, stems from some of the original comments that Marx made. Although I'm not a Marxologist, but I tend to think that those comments by Marx, where he talks about, he talks sort of derisively about writing recipes for cookshops of the future, are often misinterpreted to mean that you should never talk about these kinds of institutions in the future at all. I mean, Marx himself did, as I mentioned. If you read Critique of the Goethe Program, he actually talks pretty explicitly about some ideas of what he thinks a communist society would look like in its earlier stages and in its later stages. And then, later, I think that once we actually had a working model of a supposedly socialist society, then the logic coming from Moscow was, as the phrase goes, this is really existing socialism. When the Czechs tried to that quote from Brezhnev, really existing socialism, and it was in response to the events in Czechoslovakia where they tried to come up with a new model. So I mean, that was a sort of a real life effort to come sort of formulate new blueprints in Czechoslovakia of socialism with a human face and they had a lot of theorists who talked about different ideas about introducing markets or market socialism. And Brezhnev, you know, after crushing that experiment with tanks, he said, this is really existing socialism. So the sort of Soviet tradition was a real break on that line of writing and thinking. But then there's also, I think, a utopian or a philosophical commitment nowadays in the last few decades among especially a lot of intellectuals with an academic orientation towards Marxism, which I don't quite really get entirely, where they don't like talking about this sort of stuff. I think that there's a certain element of reality to their hesitations, because sometimes these kinds of discussions can devolve into what Bhaskar Sankara, the founder of Jacobin, likes to call socialist fan fiction.
But there's also an element of, this is so difficult, I'd really rather not talk about it. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing to say, what would you do, wise guy? And then you say, well, I'm not quite sure.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that there's a lot of, you know, people have a lot of very strongly held emotional commitments to their politics, which is good. But often those are exactly the kinds of psychic orientations that really end up being roadblocks to people being able to give a coherent account of what they're after. Right now, these days, there's actually this new thing, this internet meme, in certain precincts of the young radical left, which is full communism. I don't know if you've seen this, but you see this popping up a lot. Like it's sort of like half a joke, but half serious. You know, people will say things like, you know, all I want for Christmas is full communism, sort of as a joke, but there's sort of like one of those jokes that's not really a joke, because it's a kind of defensive laughter about the inability or unwillingness to sort of name our desires, name where we want to go.
Well, I also wish I were 30 years old again and looked like Robert Redford, but, you know, one can't always get what one wants.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is that there used to be a problem with naming the system. That used to be the big obstacle in the Cold War era. You know, there's a speech by, I forget who it was, the SDS leader at the anti-war demonstration in 1965, where he said, we must name the system that's causing all of this misery. But the irony is that, you know, he actually never named the system in that speech, because it would be too controversial to actually talk about capitalism. And nowadays, now that the Cold War is over, now there's no Soviet Union, nobody has any problem talking about capitalism. That word is fine, both on the left and the right, whether you're critical of it or supportive of it. But talking about where you want to go, so there's a real blank spot.
Now, someone who has, or two people who have done a lot of work on the where we should go question are Michael Albert and Robin Hanel, who put together something called Paracon, Participatory Economics. Now, the best criticism of Paracon that I ever heard was Nancy Fulbray's, which is, it sounds like, it's a vision of life as one long student council meeting. Tell us what Paracon is and what your problems with it are.
Well, you know, in some ways I think it's a very useful exercise that they've performed, Albert and Hanel, because they sort of take the premise of a lot of discussion on the far left about where we want to go, the idea that we want a real, you know, like full communism, as they say, pure communism, a pure version of from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. And then they actually, as opposed to what most people do, which is just sort of cough and mumble about how that would actually work, they actually sit down and they figure out what would concretely be necessary institutionally in order to implement that. And the result, I mean, I think is, you know, may actually, it's very difficult when you read their proposals to imagine this thing actually happening, but it actually does at least make a certain theoretical sense that this is what would be necessary in order to have a system where, you know, everybody chooses how much they work and what they do, and everybody takes goods freely and there's no market allocation and so on. And basically, you know, it's very complicated, but at the beginning of every year, everyone has to write out a list of all of the goods that they plan to consume over the course of the year, because of course there's no market, so you have to plan. So if you're going to plan, and it's going to be a democratic plan as opposed to some top-down central planning type operation, then everybody has to participate in the formulation of the plan, with their own contributing their own little piece of information about how much they're going to work and what they're going to consume. So you literally sit down and you write out a list of all of the goods you're going to consume over the course of the year. And this is one of those things where Albert and Hanel will respond to critics by just sort of saying, look, we don't see why that would be a problem. It ends up just being one of those things where all I can say is, this is what I said in the piece, all I can say is that I think I speak for a lot of people when I say that it's very hard for me to imagine this being something that most people could live with.
The money system and going shopping actually is, in some sense, a time saver. I mean, you just do what you want when you want to, and you don't have to do a whole lot of advanced planning. And this, who can anticipate one's needs 11 months hence?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But you know, once you say that, then you're saying that there is some advantage, however mixed with a lot of disadvantages, to markets or to shopping. And to trespass on in that dangerous region, you know, elicits a lot of anguished responses on the left.
Well, I think underlying a lot of this is a sense that shopping is decadent, and we should get by with a lot less, and even of lower quality. There's a certain austerian quality to a lot of these utopian visioning.
Yeah, and you know, I think that in the best version of that impulse is the sort of green idea that, you know, why should we spend our lives working more and more in order to have more and more goods? I mean, you know, there are certain avenues of criticism along those lines that make sense to me, but in the end, a lot of these responses end up, like you say, sort of forthrightly admitting that who cares whether we have goods that are abundant and kind of good quality and that you can actually obtain in a way that's that doesn't take up a huge part of your life. And it seems to me that that's just it's of very little relevance to the needs of most of the people that we're interested in doing something for.
My friend Sean Jacobs used to use as a signature line in emails a line from a Brazilian samba, which is only intellectuals love poverty, poor people love luxury.
That's it.
Let's talk some about the economic problem that these kinds of designs have to get control of, meaning things like the allocation of resources and all these complex input-output things. I mean, what is the problem that the market solves in a technical sense that any kind of socialist dreamer has to address?
Well, what the market does is it provides one method for economic calculation. It's not a perfect method. It's, in fact, very imperfect. But it provides one rational method, among others, for economic calculation, which means dealing with the very, very serious problem of how you coordinate an economy that involves a massive division of labor. A lot of times when people talk about their vision for a communist society or something like that, they use these analogies from very small units. So in other words, they think like, you know, if a bunch of roommates in an apartment decide to, you know, bake a cake together or something, well, they don't need markets. They don't need to set a price or exchange the flour for the eggs if they're all standing in the kitchen cooperating, producing this cake. So why would we need to do that at the level of an entire society? And this is, you know, sort of a classic, I don't know if it's really a fallacy of composition, but it's certainly a fallacy of scale. Because when you have a massive division of labor, as we do and as is necessary in order to have the kind of technological standard of living that we have, where you literally have millions of people, billions of people and millions of different products in a vast and integrated system of production and distribution, then you need some rational way in order to figure out what, you know, what each person in the system ought to do. And that's an extremely difficult problem. That's, you know, the central planning represented an alternative to markets as one method of doing this. And it worked in the sense that it happened. You know, it was a system that actually functioned.
And you cite some evidence showing that it was not anywhere near as inefficient as some of the more rabid opponents say.
Absolutely. And this is one of the points that I try to make, is that you need some method of economic calculation. But the idea that markets provide not only a method, but some sort of ideal, optimal, perfect method, is actually a great fallacy. It's a fallacy that was promoted by a lot of Western economists, especially in the high Cold War era. And, you know, as I go through in the piece and I show that there was very late in the game towards the end of the Soviet system, there were a lot of economists, microeconomists, who went and applied the techniques of of micro, very advanced techniques of microeconomics, empirically looking at how factors of production are allocated among industries to look at the allocational efficiency of Soviet type economies and comparing them with capitalist economies. And it became clear that actually they were really just as efficient as in a neoclassical sense, in the sense of how goods are allocated among different parts of the economy to produce a maximum output as in the capitalist world. That was not really where the problem lay.
Back to the question of aggregating small-scale models to large-scale ones. You know, I think a lot of our anarchist comrades also have a vision that sees that, you know, small-scale cooperative enterprises can somehow be a model for a much larger society. But really, will that work in practice?
Well, no, and I think that's the problem of the scale. That's the problem of scale. And it's one that, the reason why I discuss Albert and Hahnel is because I think that they actually perform the service of showing what would be necessary in order to bring up that kind of scale, in order to run the economy as close as possible to sort of one giant commune. But one point that I wanted to make before is that this idea that central planning was inefficient, quote unquote, that was the problem with it. It was promoted by a lot of Western economists who were, you know, anti-communist and anti-socialist. But it was also, ironically, accepted by a lot of the tradition of socialist economics, of, you know, people who were socialists who were interested in the economics of socialism over the decades. They sort of, neoclassical economics was like the only game in town in a sophisticated way analyzing the operation of a big, large-scale economy. And so a lot of those efforts by socialist economists to figure out how to make socialist economies function better were based on the idea that if you could just get the economy to be more efficient, to allocate goods in a more rational way, then that would solve the problem. But that wasn't really where the problem lay with those centrally planned systems.
Where did it lie?
Well, it lay in the ability to sort of gather information about how to make new things, how to make new products, how to make them in new different ways, and how to make them better. That figuring out how to do that and then actually being able to implement that requires a level of flexibility, an ability for a system to be able to tap into the very dispersed knowledge. This is a notion that Hayek was known for talking about, and I don't think there's any reason to be scared off by that. You know, to take a really simple example, if I look at my neighborhood and I say this neighborhood could use a good Thai restaurant, that's an example of a little bit of local knowledge that a central planning board or a central ministry of distribution would have a very hard time being able to identify in every neighborhood of an entire vast country.
Now, there's an argument that the Soviet-style central planning just didn't have the computing power to handle the planning task. I think probably the MacBook we're recording this on has more computing power than Gosplan had in 1960. So is there anything to that argument that a more IT-adept set of central planning authorities could do a better job of it?
I don't really think so, because again, for the same reason, that those computers, what they can do is they can improve your ability to calculate what would be the most to optimize. In other words, to figure out what the best way of allocating a given set of resources is. But I don't think that was really the problem with those centrally planned economies. They were not having trouble allocating the resources they already had. They were having trouble generating new ways of creating more resources and improved resources. And to do that, it requires a lot of flexibility in the system. You know, I mean, if you have an idea of for a new way of producing something or a new thing to produce, then, I mean, you as an individual, whoever you happen to be, you know, who do you go to? Is there one ministry of innovation where you have to apply, and if they reject you, that's the end of the story? And what are the incentives for them to even try to fiddle with this vast, extremely complicated plan to test out your idea? Those were the kinds of rigidities that produced the problems with central planning, at least the problems that I think generated the most dissatisfaction.
I'll speak with Seth Ackerman, who is an editor at Jacobin and author of The Red and the Black, an article on a possible socialism in the new issue of that magazine. So your solution, it's a version of something that's been around for a long time, a market socialism. What's your particular angle on it?
The ideas that I lay out for these institutions are not incredibly groundbreaking and revolutionary. They build on ideas that have been around for a while, because there was a sort of flowering of a literature on market socialism in the late 80s, early 90s, which was in part motivated, I think, by efforts to come to grips with what was going on in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, with figuring out like ways of transitioning out of socialism and sort of hybrid systems and things like that. And so what I lay out is sort of a thought experiment. What would happen if a central common fund, a common public fund, were to, if you euphemistically say, would buy up, but these would be rather compulsory purchases, all of the financial assets that were held by private actors in the economy. So all of the claims on money flows, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, et cetera, that were owned by private individuals, and paid for those financial assets by paying those individuals with a deposit in a bank account. But now the bank accounts would all be in banks that are socially owned, because the common fund would own all of the shares of all the banks. Then you would have a system where now what you've done is you've socialized that function that the financial system performs under capitalism, which is to sort of intermediate between the individual's money savings, or financial savings, and the physical productive infrastructure of the economy.
But it's also a system of exercising ownership and control. It's not just a matter of moving funds around.
Exactly. And this is a key point, is that, I call it a socialization of finance. And when people hear that, there's often a sort of confusion, because there's this tendency to think about finance as something that you can fiddle with without really getting into the mechanisms of the deep mechanisms of power and ownership and control. But the whole purpose of this in reality is to get at the mechanisms of ownership and control, is to transfer ownership and control to a public fund. And that's what finance does. And there's really no way to get around that.
This sounds somewhat like the Swedish experiment and the wage earner funds, which are going to buy corporate Sweden through the pension funds of Swedish workers. That ended up getting watered down and then was wound up. And I'm thinking about the politics of this sort of thing. The current owners of the means of production will not be very happy with this proposal. So, and since I would think that the political environment in Sweden is considerably friendlier to this sort of thing than it would be in the United States, can you imagine a way of getting there?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the point of laying out these ideas is not to pretend like this is something that could happen tomorrow or the next day, and it's certainly not something that you can sort of have your Congress or Parliament pass or write a letter to your congressman and hope that it could become a policy proposal. It's not a policy proposal. It's a scenario for an option of what we could do if we find ourselves in a position in the future politically where, in a very different situation politically, where popular movements have become a lot stronger, where the contradictions have gotten a lot sharper, where probably by that point a lot of reforms will have been attempted, but people are dissatisfied with them, and there's a lot of ferment, and people think, well, what do we do next? And, in some ways, what I would hope that it could represent is a sort of bargaining chip, a sort of an intellectual bargaining chip or a theoretical bargaining chip, in the sense that when you demand reforms that the powers that be refuse to concede, the question is always, what'll you do if they don't give in? And then it becomes sort of like a game theory thing. If they don't concede our demands, then we could always just take over their stuff. But then if we take over their stuff, what do we do then? Are we stuck with a Soviet-type system? Are we stuck with the kind of systems that very few people are particularly interested in reviving? That becomes a deterrent for us. So the idea, I think, is to be able to allow us to imagine what could happen at a point where reforms have exhausted themselves, where we feel our power and we want to move beyond that stage, and to be able to think of a way that doesn't involve tearing down every aspect of the old society and trying to build something totally unrecognizable in its place. It becomes much easier to imagine taking that next step of really, expropriating the expropriators, when it doesn't have to involve, changing every aspect of your life.
How would these socialized enterprises relate to each other and to consumers?
Well, I leave that pretty open. the idea is that the enterprises would be autonomous from each other in the same sense that they are under capitalism. And this is the argument that I make about the problems that faced centrally planned systems, is that the problem with them was not really that it was a central planning rather than markets that were determining the prices and the allocation, but rather that the firms were not autonomous from each other. An autonomous firm is a firm that, you know, we're all very familiar with it, so, you know, this is not so surprising, but an autonomous firm is a firm that can enter a market, it can choose what to do, what to produce, and how to produce it, and, you know, it has to close down if it can't get by on its own resources, you know, with some margin of error on that front, as opposed to a firm that depends entirely on some superior ministry. So the idea is that these firms would be autonomous in that sense, which is totally familiar. It's the kind of system that we have today. They would be the assets would be owned by actors in the capital markets, which is, again, is sort of the same form as the system we have today. Companies are owned by people in the capital market, shareholders and pension funds, mutual funds, and so on. Only in this case, those entities are themselves socialized, and they operate as part of a common public organization.
But wouldn't they be under the same incentives to exploit workers and cheat customers and create products full of planned obsolescence, pollute, externalize costs? Wouldn't they be under the same sets of incentives that capitalist firms are under now?
Well, I think the first thing, for me, one of the most important reasons why you would want a system like this in the first place is because I think it permits, among many other things, it's many things that it permits that the current system doesn't. But one of them is a much greater degree of worker control over the production. Whatever degree that means, whether it's, you know, some kind of strong co-determination or even a totally labor-managed firm that somehow has the assets owned by an external actor. So, you know, on the front of the relationships between, you know, the management of these enterprises and their workers, part of the whole purpose of this is to have a system where the management of firms are not answerable to private shareholders who represent a narrow capitalist class that wants to maximize its control and maximize its profitability. I mean, it's true. If society as a whole doesn't want a greater degree of worker control, doesn't want a greater degree of equality or any kinds of social reforms, then it won't get those things. But the point of this kind of institutional structure is to expand the limits of the kinds of societal reforms that are possible, but that are not possible under capitalist institutions for political reasons. Under capitalism, there's all sorts of economic reasons why reforms run into trouble. But I think usually those economic reasons are surmountable. But to surmount them, you require even deeper interventions into the sort of the belly of the beast, the logic of the system, the ownership and control. And once you do that, then you get enormous pushback, like the Swedes did from their own capitalist class, when they realized that to solve some of their problems, they needed further, deeper interventions into the mechanisms of ownership and control. Then their capitalist class really mobilized and tried to defeat it. That's the point, is to try to get rid of that sort of sleeping, that tiger, you know, in the cage, that you don't want to poke it and leave it lying there.
So these socialized firms, ideally, would be governed not just by some kind of socialized shareholder, but also public interest and worker interest represented on the governing board.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the mechanisms, you know, and the kinds of mechanisms that you'd want to use to do that are completely open. And the point is that in doing that, you're not intruding. You're no longer forced to intrude on the private prerogatives of private capital owners. If society wants to do that, if society wants to put an environmental advocate or somebody from the Ministry of Ecology or a member of the community on the board of a firm, that's a decision that society can make without intruding on the most intimate relationships of property.
In your piece, and you conclude in this note, you address the fact that a lot of communists and revolutionaries have had a dream of creating a new system that essentially solved all human problems, that brought about heaven on earth. You're looking for something somewhat different.
Yeah, I think that it's a mistake to ask too much of those kinds of utopias. I think the dreams that motivate that kind of utopian imagination can often be a useful source of radical energy. But in practice, the idea that we need to think about are what we're doing as an attempt to get to some final destination where all of our problems are solved is a real mistake because I mean that's the real utopian thinking. History doesn't end, and you know what I'm trying to do here is to say what are the practical steps, the next steps that we could take.
Oh, Seth Ackerman, one of the editors of Jacobin, who has a piece in the Outlines of a Practical Socialism in the current issue of the magazine. You can find it on the web at JacobinMag, all one word, JacobinMag.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, more Emily Haynes, this with her band Metric, doing some of Handshakes on the Imperatives of Consumer Capitalism. Till next week, bye.